The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. It's back after the weekend. And this whole Zoom and televideo conferencing thing is, it was a great novelty. I mean, I've been using Skype, honestly, since it first came out. I don't know what it was. I don't even think it was 2010. It was probably before that.
Yeah, you forced us to do Skype calls.
I did, yeah. So, I'm accustomed to it. But I got to tell you that I'm getting kind of zoomed out. Like, I find the whole experience rather fatiguing. So it's kind of
cool.
You don't
like the four-hour Zoom calls?
Four? I mean, I've been on days when it's been like eight or nine. And then you get off it, and then on the weekend, you're Zooming with your family. And so it's like some sort of bizarre virtual existence that I even had somebody put another Zoom call in one of the Zoom frames, which sort of begs existential questions. But anyway, that's somewhat philosophical. It's definitely affecting the way we live, work, and play, and the way that we live, work, and play affects the way we get our energy and consume our energy. And that, of course, is changing. That's what we're going to continue to talk about today. Certainly, the rise of the video and teleconference as in face of this pandemic has facilitated potentially some permanent changes in the way that we see demand going forward. So we want to talk a little bit about that. But that trickles right up the pipeline to oil and gas reservoirs. And so to discuss that, we've got a very special guest today.
Yeah, we'd want to welcome Bobby Tudor, who serves as the co-head of the advisory business of Perella Weinberg Partners and is chairman and founder of Tudor Pickering Holt Company. Welcome, Bobby.
Thanks very much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, welcome. It's good to talk with you again, Bobby. I think we've known each other probably, 15 years or so, right around the time I met you when I published my first book, 1,000 Barrels a Second. 1,000 Barrels a Second was 84.6 million barrels a day. So that's how long it was. But, well, here we are again. We're actually below 84.6 million barrels a day. I think we're down to 70 million barrels per day. So we're going to talk about the pandemic and the current oil market crisis, get the perspectives of Bobby from the U.S. lens. Importantly, we're going to talk about the state of the capital markets and the dearth of capital in the oil and gas business, not only the oil and gas, but I think every segment of energy. And then importantly, talk also a little bit about the future of energy.
Okay, but before we start, Bobby, maybe give the audience a brief summary of yourself.
Sure. Well, I'm a longtime energy banker. Started my career at Goldman Sachs in the late 80s. Actually, started in August of 1987 and stood around the Bloomberg machine in October of 1987 as the markets crashed. And I've told some of our young people in the last few weeks or so, don't worry, take a long view. We will come back. It may take a while, but we will come back. So I spent 20 years at Goldman Sachs, really in the energy business, my first five in New York. They asked me to move to Houston to start a new effort there, which I did, and spent 10 years in Houston leading the firm's energy efforts in Houston, and then moved to London, where I led our international energy business. So I was at Goldman Sachs almost 20 years. I left Goldman Sachs end of 2006 with the idea that I would like to do something more entrepreneurial and felt that there was room for a specialist energy firm in the U.S. market, and started TPH along with my partners Dan Pickering and Maynard Holt in February of 2007. And so we have built the firm quite aggressively. I think, as you guys know, we have a meaningful presence in Calgary with a terrific team led by Derek Wheatley and Richard Matthews. And really, to improve our international footprint and our liability management footprint, we merged with Perella Weinberg Partners at the end of 2016 with the idea that we needed a partner to grow, and in particular, a partner that would bring us kind of leverage what we were already doing. And PWP did that. So we merged in 2016, and we're now part of Perella Weinberg Partners, which is a bigger global M&A advisory firm. So that's the history. It's been great fun and interesting. I've seen a few cycles, but I will say, each one has a bit of a different flavor, and this one really has a different flavor.
Well, and so have you seen anything as severe in all those years of your investing career?
No, look, the disruption that happened with the financial crisis in 2008 was really meaningful disruption, and we did have a very abrupt fall off in demand, but that was quite short-lived. And fundamentally, what was happening in the energy market at the time was that the U.S. kind of unconventional revolution, or the shale revolution, was just getting underway, and it actually ushered in a period of incredible growth for the U.S. business. And it seemed like the financial crisis really kind of didn't slow the energy business down at all. Where we are today is quite a different place, because even prior to the COVID outbreak and prior to the pillow fight between the Russians and the Saudis, the business was a bit wobbly anyway. And it was wobbly because the returns that had been generated for investors in the previous decade had been pretty uninspiring. And the capital markets were already effectively on a capital strike, if you will, for the energy business. And so we went into this a little weak, and thus the body blows associated with it are all the more painful.
Yeah, I mean, if you think of this as just a huge body blow to demand, I think we've seen something like estimates of 30 million barrels, you know, from 100 down to 70 million barrels a day. OPEC Plus, I think it was a week ago, right, Jackie, that sort of came out with the announcement they were going to cut 10 million barrels away. I mean, everybody in the business knew that wasn't enough. You had to do more. Today, we're seeing the very blunt hammer of price. Basically, in inland regions, we've got negative pricing now.
Even where they aren't negative, they're below the cash cost of extraction.
Yeah.
So to say that the business is fundamentally uneconomic at these levels would be a vast understatement.
So do you think, I mean, there was talk a week ago, 10 days ago, that governments may step in, you know, the Texas Railroad Commission, on behalf of the government of Texas, to prorate, in other words, curtail production? Do you think that's still in the cards, or is it just going to let price do it?
Well, it's still being discussed. I'm a little skeptical, actually, that that is going to happen. I would say the industry in the U.S. is quite split on that as the appropriate solution. And there's, you know, there's quite a large group that says, look, the best cure for low oil prices is low oil prices, and production just needs to react to that, and it needs to happen via shut-ins. The complicating factor here is that some high percentage of U.S. production was actually hedged through 2020 and hedged at prices in the 40s, mostly. The companies who are hedged aren't feeling as much pressure to shut in that production because they're still getting $40 plus for their oil. If you're unhedged, you have quite a different point of view, of course. I suspect that there will ultimately be some sort of accommodation, perhaps more likely to be tied up with the issue of flaring, which is to say, by changing the flaring rules, it will effectively shut in production without requiring proration.
So curtailing the flaring of natural gas.
Correct.
As a means to, because there's a lot of natural gas that's produced by association with oil. And so if you curb the flaring, that you automatically have to shut in your oil.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So how much do you think, though, like without that, without any government intervention, how much do you think could potentially be shut in the U.S.? And you're accommodating for, you know, people that are hedged or people that maybe have lower costs.
About 3 million barrels is likely to get shut in pretty quickly. And it will start with stripper wells. So the conventional wells that produce just, you know, a few barrels a day. And the reason you start there is that these prices are below the cash cost of extracting those wells.
So to put it in perspective, like 3 million barrels a day is about a quarter of U.S. production.
That's right.
In the 80s, which we can both reminisce on, when the price went really low, a lot of those stripper wells were shut in and they never came back. Do you think that's a possibility here?
Sure. You know, every reservoir is different, but there are certainly places where when you shut in production, there's damage to the well in a way that it never becomes economic again. And of course, that's something that producers are quite worried about. But you don't want to produce if the cost of extracting it is higher than what you're getting for selling the barrel. So we do think some amount of what gets shut in will not come back. And that just begs the question of, you know, even assuming we get back to normal levels of demand at some point, you know, in the next year or so, what will the U.S. share of that demand be? And will the U.S. share going forward end up lower than it was going into this crisis? And I think right now the working assumption is, yes, it probably will be a bit lower, but we will see how that plays out.
You think it would just be a bit lower. I mean, when you think about the declines, if the U.S. wasn't to invest at all for the next year, I think if you look at the EIA data, it would show almost declines of 4 million barrels a day in 12 months on top of any shut-ins. Do you think it's possible that the U.S. is maybe 4 million barrels a day lower a year or 18 months from now than they are today at 13 million barrels?
It is, certainly is possible just because of the declines, as you mentioned. On the other hand, the real advantage of the U.S. unconventional world is that it's very short cycle stuff, which is to say you can actually turn it back on and have it ramp back up pretty quickly relative to most other forms of production around the world. I told someone recently that actually this short cycle production in the U.S. right now is doing exactly what it was intended to do when the large companies who shifted capital away from international exploration and towards U.S. onshore, when they did it, this is why they did it, which is to say when you have really dramatic drops in price, it's nice to have a big chunk of your capital program that you can actually turn off quite quickly and then later turn back on quite quickly. That is much less true in the deep water, for example, or in other major kind of big ticket developments around the world. And so in that sense, this short cycle production in the U.S. is doing exactly what it promised.
We'll come back to that short cycle notion because obviously it takes capital to start it back up. And I want to come back to the idea of where the capital is going to come from in a constrained world. But can we come back a little bit to the demand side where you said some expectation that we may get back up to 100 million barrels per day or what we'll call normal within the next, 12 to 18 months. Do you feel that's possible? I mean, I sense that, getting back to 100 million barrels a day with some of the lifestyle changes that we're seeing may take a bit longer than we think.
Yeah, it will be really interesting to see what happens to consumer behavior in particular. The percent of the total barrel that's used for commuting to and from work and for flying on airplanes is a reasonably, high number. That's, just south of 20% of the total barrel. And so to the degree that we see meaningful changes in consumer behavior that stick, then you could well see less demand associated with it. I think there's another big question just around global movement of goods and services and whether we will see changes in that part of both consumer behavior and industrial behavior. And if that's the case, that could also be downward pressure on demand. On the other hand, petrochemical demand tends to follow kind of global GDP and global demographics, and it seems unlikely that that's going to change dramatically. Then the other question is, will this big dip in prices ultimately serve to accelerate the transition to electric vehicles, or will it in fact slow the transition to electric vehicles? And that's a big open question as well. So a lot of moving pieces as regards to what's going to happen to global demand over the course of the next call it year or two. Part of that it just has to do with when we get comfortable with normal behavior related to COVID. Mm-hmm. And that seems a very open question as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I think about the future, the supply stuff is actually fairly easy to think about, right? We know at certain prices, supply will contract, and at other higher prices, there'll be money to invest. And we have a sense of where the supply is coming from and which supply may be shut in or not. But the demand is really the thing that we just have no analog to what has happened in the past that's anything like this. And the longer this lasts, I fear that people are kind of getting into their new lifestyles and maybe will behave differently as they come out of this.
It certainly seems plausible that fundamentally consumer behavior will change meaningfully, but we'll see.
Yeah, I think the interesting question to me is, let's say we just get back to 95 or something like that. The supply response globally, like you mentioned the offshore platforms and the shelving of some of those, like we could actually see supply cuts greater than demand cuts. At least that's a conjecture that I'm thinking about, in which case that's relatively bullish for price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, one of the things we know about the oil and gas business is that because of natural decline, if you don't invest capital, then production will drop, and it will drop dramatically. Even if global demand goes to 95 million barrels instead of 100, there's still 5 or 6 million barrels of decline every year, and we have to come up with those new barrels somewhere. And so we are not of a mind that global demand will fundamentally start to go into an inexorable decline right away. Even if we kind of reset the bar at a lower level, our guess would be from that lower level, it actually will grow again, at least for a period of time. And our view would be kind of in the range of 15 years or so. So we're still going to need oil and natural gas. We're going to need a lot of it. And if we don't put capital into the ground, we'll ultimately get a lot less of it. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, you're right, that is bullish for price.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that capital issue, to talk about the capital markets, debt and equity. We know before the crisis that the North American, I'll call it the Western, oil and gas industry was under tremendous pressure from environmental groups and so on. And also what you mentioned earlier, that there was tremendous pressure on the oil and gas companies to make a return for their investors. So the equity markets had dried up. And now I sense the banks are taking a bath in oil and gas on the debt side. So if we come out of this with no equity and much more constrained debt, how do you ramp the Western oil and gas industry back up again?
Yeah, it's a big challenge. I actually do believe that money will flow into the industry when money has confidence that the industry can generate returns that are above their cost of capital.
Mm-hmm.
And it will come from all directions. It will come from the public markets. It will come from the private markets, both equity and debt. And that's notwithstanding kind of broader ESG pressures and concerns. The question, though, is how much evidence are the capital markets going to demand around this return issue before they're willing to, you know, come back in, if you will. Prior to this big fall in price, actually, I felt the U.S. industry anyway, and Canada to some degree as well, was doing quite an effective job of changing their behavior mm-hmm. to focus on generating free cash at the expense of growth. So growth was coming down and coming down dramatically, and free cash was going up. Now, not every company was in a position to do that, whether because of their balance sheet or their asset base, but many were, and returns were beginning to improve. But it was still quite early days, and now we've had this big drop in price, and it's kind of stalled that whole movement, if you will. You know, one of the things we know is that there is a lot of capital that follows momentum, and if capital gets a sense that we have oil prices that are going to go from 20 back to 60, capital will flow into the business. Just mark my words. It will.
Yeah.
Well, we had a theory, though, that investors were staying away from the industry. We might need 2 years of showing reliable returns to really get investors back to prove that the industry could be profitable. And now you have this black swan event that may just scare many investors away from the sector altogether. They'll be worried about the next black swan that could hammer down oil demand and the value of their investments. Do you think that would keep people away?
Yeah, I think it will keep some people away. The question is, will there be enough people that it won't keep away? And I would suggest that once we get upward pressure on oil and gas prices, then people will come back in. You know, I think one thing we have to remember is that at $43 WTI, it did feel like we were going to need to show 2 years-ish of attractive returns before we would start to attract much new capital. But that was with the assumption that 40-ish dollars WTI was kind of where we were, and there wasn't a bunch of upside pressure to that number or necessarily downside pressure to that number. What an event like this does is it reminds people that cycles do happen for all kinds of reasons. No one could have predicted this one, obviously, but we certainly had other periods that where we've had dramatic drops and dramatic rises in commodity price in relatively short periods of time. So when that happens, these companies can go from being unprofitable or only marginally profitable to being very profitable very quickly if they will show some discipline. So I'm reminded of the bumper sticker you saw in Texas and in Houston in the early 80s that said, "Dear Lord, please give me $50 oil again. I promise not to screw it up this time."
Yeah, yeah, we had those here too.
And so,
in different language.
Yes, exactly. So we will see.
Yeah, this is definitely a down cycle. I would say we're like falling off a bicycle is what's happened here and getting really bruised up. But, you know, investors do love a beaten up industry when in the investment business, say when there's blood on the streets, that's when you come in. I guess my question now would be, where do you see it coming into? Do you see it coming in from the private equity side, the private capital side, you know, where institutional investors, the pension plans, the university endowments and so on have been reluctant to put money into energy because of the climate change concerns? Or do you see it coming additional capital into this beaten up space from the public side?
I think it will come from all directions, though. My guess is that it will be more heavily weighted this time around to the public markets than to private equity, because I do think that the ESG concerns have dampened broader private equity appetite for the business. Not in all quarters, and there are plenty of private equity investors who intend to be active in this down cycle, and we talk to them every day. But I think as a broad proposition, I think it's true that there will be less private capital available to the industry in the next kind of 3 to 5 years than there has been in the last 3 to 5. I think that's almost certainly the case. So it will need to come from the public markets, both equity and debt, and it will need to come from companies that are generating free cash. And there is such a unicorn, actually. Not necessarily at $20. There aren't many unicorns like that, but certainly at $40 there are, and we will see their cash reinvested in the business as well.
So one thing that the industry could do is become lower cost by consolidating so that they are more resilient at lower prices. Do you think this cycle is going to result in M&A?
Yeah, we do. And actually, that already started in the U.S. I mean, the last year to 18 months has seen an unusually high amount of consolidation in the business. Periods like this tend to accelerate that, if you will. But one of the effects of this really dramatic drop in price is that there are plenty of companies, both in the upstream and in the midstream and in oilfield services in particular, who just don't have the balance sheets to survive should this go on for any protracted mm-hmm. period of time. And when I say protracted period of time, I mean beyond 3 to 6 months.
Yeah.
So that also tends to drive consolidation, because what happens is the debt holders end up with the equity of the company. They're not naturally owners of that equity, so they very much want to sell and or merge into others. And so that kind of wave of restructuring will ultimately result in consolidation as well. So yes, we do see quite an active market for consolidation evolving in the next 2 years.
So it seems like the early consolidation as a consequence of the situation may be done by the banks themselves as companies go into bankruptcy. I've heard the large American banks are actually setting up divisions to take control of the proverbial pump house and oil fields, and they may be consolidating only to repackage and sell this stuff later.
Yeah, that's right. And the reason they're doing that this time around, they didn't do that last time around, but the reason they didn't was that last time around, the kind of A&D market or the asset market remained open and relatively healthy. That's just not the case now. There actually is virtually no asset market in the U.S. or Canada, for that matter. And so the banks know that because there's no asset market, if they're going to end up as the equity owners in the businesses, they're just going to have to own them for a while.
What will their strategy be? Do you think it's going to be to blow down the assets and recover their money? Is that?
Yes, it'll be a blowdown strategy with a desire to wait on the return of the asset market and or consolidation opportunities so that they can kind of mush them all together and take out G&A that way.
Mm-hmm. And sell it off to private market hands again.
Right. Yeah. When that recovery comes, whenever that is, they'll actually maybe be buyers for these assets, but there aren't today.
Right.
All right, let's switch gears to the future of energy. What do you think is going to happen to the clean energy agenda post-COVID?
It will be very interesting to see. I have a theory that this is actually bad news for the energy transition. And the reason it's bad news is that companies are just focused on survival, number one. Number two, they don't have cash flow really to be investing in innovation. And number three, the displacement, if that happens, of production in the West, in North America generally, if the result of that is that production moves to other places in the world, it actually tends to get done with higher emissions than it gets done in the U.S. Mm-hmm. or Canada. So for a lot of reasons, I don't think this is good news for lower emissions and a transition to a lower carbon future. I think it's a setback. And while it may seem ironic in some sense, we actually need a reasonably healthy North American energy industry to help us towards energy transition, and having one that's kind of fundamentally broken does not help. I didn't mention, and here's a fairly obvious point, gasoline is really, really cheap right now.
Mm-hmm.
And what we see in consumer behavior in the U.S., I don't know if the same would be true in Canada, but what we see here is when you have gasoline that's this cheap, people buy more SUVs and they buy more pickup trucks, and they generally buy vehicles that have much lower miles per gallon.
So what you actually see is a negative carbon tax or a carbon inducement. And, you know, I sort of calculate it roughly, it's over $200 a ton, you know, relative to pre-COVID to today. It's the carbon inducement that's happened, which serves as a barrier to switching. And not only that, say, like, who's buying cars anyway? Let alone, I mean, after the financial crisis, it took 2-3 years before the cars market came back. I mean, people just hung on to their existing vehicle, let alone buy a new electric one. So, yeah, but I mean, I think there's a broader dynamic that's kind of interesting in all of this. And, you know, I would argue the biggest energy transition that may be in play, getting back to the earlier part of this conversation, is if, let's take North America as a whole, Canada and U.S., gives up market share to the Middle East and Russia, that all of a sudden the notion of energy independence and all the geopolitical baggage from 10, 15 years ago comes back, right? And now all of a sudden we're more dependent and energy security becomes an issue. Like, how do you see that potential transition playing out?
Well, like, one of the reasons the energy industry is a fun and interesting place to work is the geopolitics of it all are fascinating. And might we see a reversal of what has been accomplished in North America in the past kind of 3 or 4 years? I suppose it's absolutely conceivable that we could see a reversal of that, whether it's purely market forces that drive it or policy choices that drive it. But, you know, the politics around energy are complicated politics, even just in the U.S. standalone. So, you know, notice how after years of berating OPEC and what President Trump used to say about OPEC is the fix is in. You know, he hated OPEC. Well, all of a sudden, when we have volatility of this amount that is so destructive to U.S. jobs and economies, what politicians kind of figure out is they actually cannot live with that volatility, and thus having some stabilization sort of force in the market they find to ultimately be, you know, the lesser of two evils, if you will. And I think President Trump has come kind of face-to-face with that reality.
Do you think part of it, too, was President Trump has valued the power of having energy security, and he's used that even in his foreign policy, whether it be for gas or oil, and he saw that the potential for the U.S. to decline drastically and him lose that?
I think that's part of it, although, and maybe this may just be tied to my view of President Trump, I think he's much more kind of transactional, if you will, in his approach to most everything, including foreign policy, and that kind of broader concerns around security were less important to him than immediate political concerns around seeing economies in important states like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Texas being really, really badly damaged by prices at these levels. I don't know if you saw the transcript of the meeting that he had with the energy executives in the Oval Office, whenever that was, about 2 weeks ago. And one of the things he said was, you, speaking to this group, you have done a very good job of keeping energy prices reasonable. Now, that's quite a remarkable thing for him to say, because if you ask the CEOs of the companies in the room whether they feel like they have control over energy prices, they would laugh, of course. But that clearly was President Trump's kind of view of the industry. So, and look, the other thing to remember is that these very low energy prices are, in effect, a major tax cut to consumers,
mm-hmm.
a major, major tax cut to consumers, and particularly below $2 a gallon. It's just, and people aren't driving all that much right now, but but assuming we get back to normal levels of driving with really, really cheap gasoline prices, you've just given consumers a big tax cut.
Yeah.
So, you know, the politics around it are quite complicated and nuanced and make for strange bedfellows.
So let's talk about the politics of stimulus dollars. So certainly after the financial crisis, we saw a lot of stimulus dollars around the world go towards clean energy. And I sense, I mean, love to hear your view, that the current White House administration is unlikely to repeat the level of stimulus dollars that we saw in the financial crisis, which I count was like $80 or $100 billion or something like that. But at the subnational level, the state level, do you expect to see some stimulus dollars going into the whole clean energy, electrification, renewables type agenda?
Well, prior to COVID, I would have said yes. Regardless of what happens at the federal level, I would expect that we would still see a fair amount of that at the state level. But one of the fallouts from the COVID crisis is that state budgets will be under enormous pressure for some extended period of time, almost certainly. And so when you get that kind of budgetary pressure, you're looking for tax dollars, not to give away tax dollars.
Yeah.
And so I think that will actually put more pressure on the states to roll back some of the tax subsidies that have been in place. That being said, at the same time, we have technological advances going on in clean energy at a reasonably rapid rate. And so, for example, in most markets in the U.S., residential solar is actually now quite cost competitive with what people are paying for natural gas or certainly coal-fired electricity. So in some sense, in some markets, we actually don't need certainly the same degree of tax subsidies to encourage that transition. But not every market is the same, for sure. And there are certain markets where without those subsidies, the price just is not competitive.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, again, getting back to earlier in the conversation and the possibility of potentially a ricochet in oil prices because of permanent impairment of oil fields to meet potentially a rapid rise in demand, that actually that ricochet in oil prices could drive both an energy security agenda as well as a price agenda to do some switching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It helps the clean energy because if we have higher prices.
Yeah.
But that, so it's
negative
not immediate.
In the near term for clean energy, but potentially positive in the
That's right. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Bobby, we're coming up to the end of our time, regrettably, but we have one easy question for you to finish off. We are interested in how you think the chances of Keystone XL, will it ever get built to finally get that bullet line between Western Canada and the refiners in the Gulf Coast?
Oh, my goodness. I actually think this crisis will be helpful as regards getting projects like that ultimately completed. I think part of that is tied to the energy security issue that Peter has touched on it. I think part of it will be tied to jobs and the job creation associated with big projects like that. So on the margin, I would say the likelihood of it all has gone up a bit, but we've certainly been wrong about it before. So we'll see.
Yeah, it's been a decade in the making so far.
Yeah.
But definitely some positives with the support of the Alberta government. Capital is no longer a constraint. Now we had this ruling in Montana, right? The environmentalists are still, and I think there's something like 3 active legal cases right now. So it may take some time to work through some of that.
Yep.
Well, lots of people staying at home have plenty of time to catch up on their reading and read those rulings and among other things to do. But Bobby, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you very much for joining. Good to catch up with you and get your thoughts.
Well, it's been my great pleasure. Thank you for having me. You guys do a great service to the Energy Committee via these podcasts, and I was happy to be included.
Good. And thank you, listeners, for following us. If you like this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.